Greetings, and welcome to CatastropheCast.com. My name is Walter, and before I start, I want to say two things. One, my apologies for the delay between podcasts. Life has been very, very crazy. And two, I'm recording this just after the shooting in Connecticut, which follows the shooting in Clackamas, Oregon, which is right down the road from me. So it's been kind of an emotional week. So, and the podcast that we're going to talk about, the subject we're going to talk about, is actually also a little bit emotional. It is the crash of Alaska Airlines Flight 261. I want to give fair warning. Alaska Airlines is my primary airline of choice. I know a great many people who actually work for Alaska Airlines and their sister company, Horizon Airlines. And I have some people who are very near and dear to me who lost loved ones in this crash. So it has not been a good day, and it's probably the wrong time to touch this topic. But we're going to move on, and we're going to talk about this one. So Flight 261 was a flight that was operated regularly on Alaska Airlines, and it went from Puerto Vallarta down in Mexico, a nice little warm getaway on the beach, to San Francisco, and then continued on to Seattle. Now, if you're not familiar with Alaska Airlines, they serve a large leisure market. They connect the Pacific Northwest and the state of Alaska to warm places like Mexico. And just recently, they started flying to Hawaii. So they actually have a good segment of the leisure market. So the flight itself, Alaska Airlines Flight 261, left Puerto Vallarta at 1:37 p.m. on January 31st in the year 2000. So, you know, this is almost 13 years ago now. The plane held 83 passengers and 5 crew, 2 pilots and 3 flight attendants, making up the crew. The thing about this flight is, if you look back at January 31st, year 2000, you'll see that it's a midweek flight. Now, if you have ever been to the airport midweek, you'll notice, you know, it's a lot quieter, and that's because people who fly regularly, like me, we business travelers, we fly out on Sundays or Mondays, and we fly home on Thursdays primarily. So this flight, you know, was a midweek flight, so there was plenty of room on the flight. Of those 83 passengers, there were almost 40% of the flight was people who actually were connected to Alaska Airlines or Horizon Airlines, meaning they were an employee of one of the airlines, or they were a loved one of the airlines. Everyone should be familiar with the fact that if you work for an airline, you actually get, you know, you can fly for free. So you and your family. So, you know, so this flight actually had a lot of people who actually worked for Alaska or Horizon, or who were their loved ones. So almost half of those 83 passengers. The flight that, or the type of aircraft that this flight operated, was an MD-80 type. Now, if you're not familiar with the MD-80s, they're similar to the old DC-9s or what eventually became the Boeing 717. Boeing 717 is something that Delta operates today, and Southwest Airlines, as they took over AirTran, they operate the 717s today. Delta actually still operates a whole bunch of DC-9s. Those DC-9s are, you know, nearly 50 years old. The thing that you can recognize about these, as opposed to other aircraft, are they're very, very distinctive because the engines are mounted on the sides of the airplane at the tail. And then the tail comes up, and there's a horizontal surface at the top of the tail. So if you've ever seen if you've ever been to an airport and seen our aircraft, you're probably familiar with this type of aircraft. You've probably flown on them. If you've flown American, that's who makes up the MD-80s make up most of the number of airplane that they have. So anyway, that's the type of aircraft it was. And as I said, that tail, that very distinctive tail, is what is going to be coming into focus in a little bit later on. So on that day, the airplane had been flying for a couple of hours. And as it was nearing LAX, they said that they were having some problems with the stabilizer. So they were trying to figure out what was going on. The stabilizer, which is the top part of that tail, the flat part of the tail, that's what keeps the plane, you can move it to where the plane will go up or go down. So that part of the plane, they were having problems with it. They were trying to figure out what was going on. About 4:10 p.m., that stabilizer jammed. And when it jammed, the aircraft actually plunged from 31,500 feet down to 23,000 feet in a little over a minute. It's insane to think that for those 80 seconds, these people were in terror. But the good thing is the pilots were able to recover. So they were able to recover from this dump from nearly 10,000 feet. And they started talking to air traffic control and Alaska maintenance. Air traffic control, they basically said, we want to stay out over the ocean just in case, because if they were to lose, the pilots had the forethought, if we were to lose control of the airplane again, at least we would only be over the ocean. We would not be anywhere else. So that was very, very important to know. So they were trying to figure out, what should we do? And they were going to try and land at LAX. So a few minutes later, as they are taking control of the airplane, they had recovered. And at 4:19 p.m., there, if you listen to the cockpit voice recorder, there's a few thumps. There's just a whole bunch of really loud thumps and bangs on the cockpit voice recorder. And at that point, the plane becomes, that was the beginning of the end of that airplane. It became very, very much non-controllable. So the pilots did what they could to regain control, but they just weren't able to. They even turned the plane over so that we're flying upside down because they had figured out that, something's going on. If we can kind of jam it one way or the other, maybe, we can get it to work. So the pilots went through and, they tried and fought for this airplane to keep this airplane, steady, but it just did not work. And a few minutes later, after they had reported that, we're having problems again, they descended the final 18,000 feet and they hit the water. So they landed in the Pacific Ocean in an upside down inverted attitude. At that point, upon impact, they were traveling at, I believe it was 175 miles an hour. Everyone on that plane lost their lives instantly as soon as that plane hit water. One of the morose things about this was there were about half a dozen commercial planes that were actually in the area that air traffic control had said, can you please watch what's going on with this flight? We've got this problem flight. We need you to watch it and tell us what's going on. And there were these half a dozen commercial planes where the pilots were saying, okay, this is what's going on now. This is what's going on now. And finally, one of the last entries from a SkyWest pilot said, he's hit the water. He's done. So that was the extent of the crash. It was very sudden. The entire situation lasted probably from the first time they did the rapid descent to the time they crashed in the Pacific Ocean was just over 10 minutes. The NTSB immediately got out there to start investigating. And luckily, unlike other crashes in the ocean like Swissair 111 or TWA Flight 800, they were actually able to recover quite a bit of the airplane frame. They recovered about 85%. And because they knew that the plane was having problems with their stabilizer, that's where they wanted to look at first. This stabilizer was controlled by what's called the ACME screw, or as this is the first time when I was investigating this that I actually found out it's called the ACME screw, because as long as I've ever known about it, it's called the jack screw. Because they reported the stabilizer problem, that's what the NTSB decided to look at first. So they've regathered as much of the plane as they can, and they got the jack screw and the nut assembly that the jack screw went into. And they found out that 90% of the threads in the nut assembly itself were actually worn away. I mean, this was pretty mind-blowing. If you think of it this way, so you've got a regular, small screw in your hand. If you pick up a nut and you start to screw it on, because, that nut fits, so you start to screw it onto the screw, it fits tight and it stays there. And it does exactly what it's supposed to do. It holds. Well, think of it this way. Less like a nut and more like a washer. If you've ever taken a screw and put it in a washer, it just slides right in and out. And that's actually what happened here. The jack screw actually had ripped so much of the threads out of the nut assembly that it was just sliding up and down. There was actually no way to control it. So when that happened, the horizontal stabilizer, basically, instead of being able to be something that you can control, pull it down so we can ascend, push it up so we can descend. Instead of that, it just becomes this piece of things, a piece of, of nothing that just reacts to the wind around it. If you've, ever held a piece of paper or a tissue or something in the breeze, coming from an air vent or out a car door window, you'll see, that piece of tissue just, flaps up and down depending on the breeze that takes it. Well, that's pretty much what was going on with this stabilizer. Because of this jack screw, and the fact that the nut part of the jack screw had been stripped, that stabilizer became nothing. It just reacted to the flow of the air. So it was pretty useless. And as soon as that happened, that pretty much said, this is the end of the flight. We're done. All right. So the NTSB knows, all right, we've got this problem with the jack screw. Let's go through and find out, what the maintenance records were. So they go through and they check the maintenance records at the Oakland base, and they find out that, okay, the last time that this jack screw had been taken through maintenance, the usual maintenance period for the lubrication and prep work and to make sure that the jack screw works properly takes about 4 hours. But the records actually showed that the mechanic did it in a quarter of that time. They only spent an hour lubricating and making sure that the jack screw worked. So right there, first thing, the maintenance was just not done properly. But that's not all. Each of these jack screws, each part of the plane has to be tested for excessive wear, just like we test for other things like metal fatigue and such. So in order to test for the excessive wear, Alaska actually manufactured a tool to be able to test it. The thing was, that tool did not meet the manufacturer's specifications. McDonnell Douglas, of course, had been snapped up by Boeing, so they were owned by Boeing, and Boeing had specifications for these jack screws and to check for the maintenance. But the tool that Alaska used actually didn't test properly. when they actually used it, they actually showed that the test results showed that the tool measured inaccurately. So that's another big blow right there. The third thing, and probably the most chilling thing about the entire investigation, is the NTSB actually, they're of course an independent organization. You know, they don't work with the FAA. They are totally independent. They don't just cover airline crashes, although that's what we know them for. So the NTSB uncovered that the FAA had actually approved the lengthening of the checks for the jack screw assemblies when it wasn't justified. Alaska Airlines said, instead of doing these every 30 days, let's do these every 180 days. I don't know the exact. I believe this was supposed to be a sea maintenance. I need to put together this list of, regular maintenance, B maintenance, C maintenance. I need to put together that list, and maybe I can put it on catastrophecast.com so people know. But the FAA actually had approved lengthening the check of these jack screw assemblies testings. And that was, that right there is pretty huge, because not only is Alaska and Alaska maintenance to blame about this crash, but the FAA was culpable, because they went right along and said, yeah, we can do that. That's fine. Don't worry about it. And then the last interesting thing about this was, when you think of an aircraft, you think of the redundant systems. So if an airplane has, for some reason, no power, there is a wind turbine. I believe I talked about this in a previous episode. There's a wind turbine that you can crank down, and it will, put some power to the instruments. Or, there's hydraulic lines throughout an entire plane to control the flaps, to control the ailerons, control all this. The jack screw had no fail-safe mechanism. There was no redundancy. If you lose one gas tank on an airplane, you can say, okay, we're going to divert. We're only going to use the gas from this other. We have two pilots in the plane. One is incapacitated. The other can fly the plane. We have, two or three hydraulic lines per line in that plane to make sure that if one hydraulic line fails, the other one will work. That just did not happen here. In the design, and I mean, this actually blows my mind. In the design, there was no fail-safe for the jack screw. If the jack screw failed, that's it. You were screwed. So it's just insane. One of the most haunting things that I came across when I was doing research for this was a quote, actually two quotes, from someone who works for the NTSB. They said, it was board member John Goglia, and they had said this. I'm pulling two of his statements out of something longer that he had said. But he said, this is a maintenance accident. Had any of the managers, mechanics, inspectors, supervisors, or FAA overseers whose job it was to protect this mechanism done their job conscientiously, this accident cannot happen. I mean, that's just freaking powerful. He's saying, any one of these people would have done their job and thought more about the people and the maintenance of this plane as opposed to the profit or just getting the job done. If they had thought that, just had that one little thought instead of, glancing over it, this accident would have never happened. And to be honest, he's right. That is one of the truest statements ever from an NTSB NTSB board member that I've ever read. It's very, very true. This was a preventable accident. There was no reason for this to have happened. As an aftermath, what happened was the NTSB their findings led to greater checks on airplanes with jack screws, and they demanded, of course, better maintenance. Now, something that strikes me is when you look at this plane, this was an MD-83. It had been in service just 8 years, probably, you know, closer to 7.5 since this accident happened in January 2000. So this plane had only been flying for 8 years, and this horrible accident happened because of poor maintenance. Delta Airlines, who, after they took over Northwest, of course, took over Northwest's entire fleet, Delta Airlines still has DC-9s, the precursor to the MD-80 line and the Boeing 717 line. Those planes are almost 50 years old, and they're still flying today. And, I mean, that just goes to show what proper maintenance can do. 50 years on, these planes haven't had a problem, but sloppy maintenance, and we lose 88 lives. There was a memorial that was constructed at Port Hanumi, I believe that's how it's pronounced, to honor the 88 people who lost their lives that day. The neat thing is, it's a sundial, and being a sundial, every January 31st at 4:22 p.m., that sundial will cast a shadow on the memorial plaque. So that's just something beautiful right there. That not only is it an honor to the memory of these people that we lost, but it's also, you know, tells a little bit of a story that the artist actually did it, so that little shadow will show up, and it makes you think even more. The captain of the flight, Captain Ted Thompson, and the first officer of the flight, Bill Tansky, either Tansky or Jansky, they were actually awarded the Airline Pilots Association's Gold Medal for Heroism. Now, of course, they didn't survive. And actually, when you look at it, that's the only time that award had been given posthumously. They have never given it to, or at least at that time, had never given it posthumously to pilots who had died. And it was because of their decision to stay out over the Pacific Ocean. Because if they had tried to, you know, before they had control of that plane, if they had tried to come in and land, they could, you know, if you've been to LAX, there is not a single bit of free space around that. There are buildings everywhere, and it could have been a much, much worse number of much, much worse accident, and a greater number of lives that were lost instead of what we see here. So the other thing was that the FAA, of course, who was culpable in the accident, they started taking maintenance a lot more seriously, and they went through and worked with Alaska Airlines to revamp their maintenance procedures. So that was, you know, that was one of the best things that could come out of this, because this put a human face, 88 human faces, on a maintenance schedule. And that's just, you know, unbelievable. Now, one thing I want to say is, now, as I record this in December 2012, there was a movie that just came out called Flight, and they've been advertising it heavily for the last few weeks on TV. It stars Denzel Washington. When asked, if you've ever seen I'll say it this way. If you have seen the previews, you'll see that this airplane, you know, Denzel Washington is, you know, gets on the airplane to fly it, and this airplane flies through the sky, and they actually put most of the crash scene, you know, in the previews. He's flying the plane upside down and this, that, and the other. And if you've seen the movie, I haven't seen the movie, But I read up on it, and in that crash, that was also, if you look at it, it looked to be a Boeing 717 or an MD-80. It's one of those types of planes. The screenwriter for this film, the screenwriter's name is John Gatens. He actually said that he based the crash loosely on what happened on Alaska Airlines Flight 261. The only thing is, of course, in 261, everyone on the plane lost their lives. When it comes to the movie Flight, I believe only six people out of the entire plane lost their lives, and it was like 115 people on the plane. So there's a very, very big difference there. I'm hemming and hawing about going to go see that movie, but after doing this podcast and the emotional connection that I actually have to this actual crash, I might want to go see it. So I don't know. What do you think? So that's it. I want to thank you for listening. I want to also put a shout out to the two people who have suggested a few items for us to cover in coming podcasts. I'm going to go ahead and start the investigation into those subjects, and let's see if we can, get them covered. If you have suggestions, I would love to hear them. You can, if you want to contact me, that would be great. And there's a suggestion link right on catastrophecast.com that says, if you have a suggestion, leave it here. So I want to say thank you to the two folks who have left our, what left the website with some information on what we should be covering next. And I want to thank you in advance. Thank you for going ahead and giving us some ideas. And also say thank you for listening. If you want to contact us again, the website is catastrophecast.com, or you can just email us at podcast@catastrophecast.com. Thanks for listening.